Thank you. Good afternoon. My name is Joseph Huff. I'm a public defender and I represent Alberto Baez. My registration number is 34384. Because of the time constraints involved here, I'm going to restrict my arguments primarily to the first two issues that I raised in the opening brief. The first issue is the speedy trial. And as this court well knows, normally speedy trial is absolute. However, there are exceptions that a court can find in order to extend speedy trial beyond, in this case, the 90-day period, because this was a retrial from a mistrial. In this particular case, the prosecution argued that it needed a continuance because it had unavailable evidence, that it had exercised due diligence, and the evidence was material to its case. I want to take issue primarily with the first and the third part of that test, the unavailability of evidence. And I think this is purely a legal matter. My position is that the evidence in this case was not unavailable as per the statute. Normally, unavailable means you have nothing. You won't be able to submit that evidence. But in this case, we had virtually the best possible replacement for live testimony, which was a videotaped deposition. And we not only had a videotaped deposition with real-time cross-examination and direct examination, but we also had the witness's prior trial transcript where he did testify in person. So my argument is the statute requires the evidence be unavailable. The evidence at issue in this case was not the physical presence of that witness. Rather, it was his testimony. That was not unavailable. That was absolutely available.
Mr. Huff, why wouldn't the people be able to assert that having live testimony would make a difference in this case?
I don't think it would have made a difference in this case because we had a video. We had cross-examination on that video. We had direct examination on that video. And if they needed to supplement anything that they felt was missing from that video deposition that was previously done, we conceded that they could absolutely use the trial transcript from the former trial where this witness did in fact testify. I can understand that in some circumstances the prosecutor would absolutely want the witness physically present, but in this case we had basically that because we had the videotape deposition in combination with the trial transcript. And again, my argument is that when the statute says that the evidence must be unavailable, it doesn't necessarily mean the witness needs to be present or not present. The evidence in this case was his testimony. That was clearly available to the prosecution and the defense.
Mr. Huff, this witness wasn't just any witness. This was a witness that was central to the prosecution's case.
Well, I would argue that his testimony was actually cumulative of the other witnesses. As this court knows, there were a number of witnesses, including Jose Medina, Eduardo Castillo, and Lucas Cummings. All of them pretty much said the exact same thing.
But this witness was riding in the car.
Well, and the jury could have observed his demeanor while testifying, his demeanor under cross-examination, his demeanor under direct examination, because we had this on video. It would have added very little, if anything, to actually have him there physically present because we did have these measures in place before this trial commenced. And even if we assume that he was material, and even if we assume that his testimony wasn't just cumulative of the other witnesses, I'll go ahead and concede that. Fine, material. That's just one of the prongs that has to be present. My argument centers upon the requirement that the evidence be unavailable. My argument is the evidence was not unavailable in this case. There's also a requirement that the prosecutor exercise due diligence, and my argument is they did not in this case. They merely represented to the court that they had spoke to Cummings military officers and superiors, and they had spoken to his parents, but they made absolutely no representation that they had ever spoke to Cummings himself or tried to make any arrangements for his live testimony, which would not have required waiving speedy trial.
Well, he was in Iraq.
Yes, but the prosecution never said, well, and we tried to see if we could make arrangements, but that was impossible. There was no representation on the record. They simply ended with, he's in Iraq, but he'll be back sometime around in January, we believe. They didn't make any further representations that they had tried to arrange for transport, tried to get him some sort of furlough, but were unable to do so.
Mr. Huff, I recall there was a further hearing at which the prosecution reported to the court that it had determined that Mr. Valles would be back, or excuse me, Mr. Cummings would be back by like January 17th. So that that was like at a supplement later hearing, so that there was, it wasn't just sometime in January, it was more specific information.
They were able to give more specific information, but they still never made an adequate representation that they had exercised any sort of due diligence. Now, had they merely said something on the record as, we've talked with his military personnel, we've tried to see if we can arrange transport, they won't allow it, that's one thing. But they never, according to the record, tried to make any sort of alternative arrangements. They just wanted his testimony to coincide with when he would normally be coming back to the United States. In my argument, that's not legally sufficient enough without more of a representation on the record to constitute due diligence. Now I'm going to move on, unless there are any other questions, to the second issue presented. That would be my confrontation issue. The court allowed the testimony of the co-defendant to come in through the co-defendant's father under a statement against interest hearsay exception. Number one, to get past the confrontation clause aspect, it has to be a firmly rooted exception to hearsay. In this court in Hagos has found that it is not a firmly rooted exception. And even if it was a firmly rooted exception, there still has to be safeguards of reliability, indicias of reliability, and that was not the case here. First of all, to be a statement against interest, the statement has to subject the declarant to some sort of criminal liability. But in this case, the statement that the co-defendant gave to his father, which was given to the jury, was absolutely not incriminating. If anything, it completely shifted the blame away from the co-defendant. It put all the blame on my client. And
Mr. Huff, yes, excuse me for interrupting
no,
you.
No, of course.
But why wouldn't the statement made by the witness subject him to criminal liability as an accomplice to first-degree extreme indifference murder?
Because he made no statements that would have legally qualified him as an accomplice. Whether he was actually an accomplice or not is another issue. The fact is, the statements he made were very limited as to his involvement. They were merely, I was riding around with Valles. Valles was the lone gunman. He explained some of the details of the offense, some of the details of the facts, but he never said anything like, I encouraged Valles to shoot at the car. I had the same mens rea as Valles. Not that he would use the term mens rea, but I had the intent that Valles murder this other person or shoot into this car. He never said anything like that. He said, look, I feel sorry, Dad, that we used your car for this, that your car was used in this, but Vias is the one that did it, not me. He's the one that shot at this car. I was just along for the ride, essentially.
Well, wasn't he driving? He wasn't just along for the ride. Wasn't he the driver of the vehicle?
I still don't think that alone would suffice to make him a complicit or under the law. It would still have to be shown that he shared the same intent. and he never made any statements to that effect. In fact, all his statements to his father were pretty much self-exculpatory. He said, look, this, you know, I was there. Yes, he might have been driving, but no, did he have any involvement in the actual shooting? According to him, he did not.
He drove away from the scene.
Well, that in and of itself might constitute complicity, aiding after the fact, but as far as complicity in the homicide itself, he said nothing to his father that would indicate that he was guilty of that. Everything was blame-shifting to Baez.
Mr. Huff, what difference, if any, does it make that the statement was to his father rather than to a law enforcement officer?
Well, it would make it non-testimonial, first of all, that it was to his father. Secondly, I think it's actually aggravated because this was his father's car. It's not as if he was opening his heart up to a friend of his or a cellmate saying, hey, I feel really bad because I helped contribute to this homicide. He was trying to explain why his father's car was used. He was trying to give excuses to his dad. He was trying to minimize his fault in this, his blame, and that's why he shifted it all to Baez. Now, your point, Your Honor, about it being non-testimonial doesn't stop the analysis in Colorado. Because even if it's non-testimonial, it can still implicate the Confrontation Clause. And the way it does that is if it's not a firmly rooted exception to hearsay and there aren't any indicias of reliability. I would argue the fact that his statement was self-exculpatory, that it shifted the blame, there's no indicias of reliability. That's aside from the fact that statement against criminal interest is not a firmly rooted exception to hearsay. I want to read just a quote real quick from Colorado Supreme Court 2005 Compton v. People. It says, DeMint still instructs whether the admission of non-testimonial statements offends the Colorado Confrontation Clause. To admit non-testimonial evidence when the defendant has not had a prior opportunity of cross-examination, the prosecution must show that the declarant is unavailable and that the statement bears sufficient indicia of reliability. We don't have that sufficient indicia of reliability here. The fact that this is a statement that the prosecution would claim this is a statement against interest, but actually he implicates his co-defendant, my client, would indicate that there is no indicia of reliability. And getting into the harm, the problem we had is, yes, there were multiple witnesses to this event, but they all underwent cross-examination, and all of their motives and biases came out. We were unable to do that to Castillo Jr. because he was a co-defendant, because he had a trial date set. He might have already been convicted by this time. But the point is, we weren't allowed to in any way cross-examine him, undermine his credibility, call into question his biases and motives, and therefore his testimony through his father remained completely unchallenged, unlike the other witnesses that we extensively cross-examined and exposed their motives and biases. I'm going to save the rest of my time for rebuttal unless there are any other questions at this point. Thank you.
Okay, Mr. Hoff.
Good afternoon, Your Honors. My name is Joseph Michaels, attorney registration number 40403. I'm here today on behalf of the people of the state of Colorado. I'd like to address, to start off with the statutory speedy trial issue, and then I can discuss the non-testimonial hearsay and possibly the third issue, the Apprendi direct file issue, if we still have time. There are four reasons the trial court did not abuse its discretion in determining good cause to grant the continuance to the statutory six-month trial. The first is that the trial court determined that the witness was unavailable, but later would be available. And I believe Judge Taubman, you even pointed out that the prosecution identified and the trial court credited a specific date that that witness would be back. Second, the prosecution exercised about the extent of due diligence that could possibly be extended. Third, the evidence, as defense counsel just conceded, was in fact material to the prosecution's case. And fourth, related to the unavailability prong, is that the deposition and the trial court testimony from the first trial was simply inadequate. I want to emphasize that this is an abuse of discretion determination, which means that this court is looking to see if there's a justifiable basis for the trial court's ruling. Here the court said that the witness was material, and it credited the prosecution's discussion that this is the key witness that we have. It is an eyewitness to the shooting who was in the defendant's car in the front seat. The eyewitness did not have a familial relationship with the defendant, as the defendant's brother was also in that car, nor did it have he have a familial relationship with Eduardo Castillo or Hector Castillo Jr., who was driving the latter.
Mr. Michaels, are you aware of any case that has held that a witness is unavailable for speedy trial purposes when there is both a deposition and a trial testimony from a previous trial of that witness?
Not directly, Your Honor. The closest that I think we have is People versus Roberts here in the Colorado Supreme Court. That's 146 P3rd 589, and that's cited in the People's Answer Brief. In that case, it dealt directly with materiality, but unavailability was also at issue implicitly. There, and in terms of most of the cases that deal with unavailability, we're talking about witnesses who are not available. We're not talking about the absence of testimony or the ability to depose them first. But in Roberts, we had a witness who had written up a statement indicating that the defendant's statements were inconsistent with previous statements that the defendant made. And that witness was pregnant and about to give birth to her child, and I believe she was in maybe Lincoln, Nebraska, but at any rate, unable to fly or drive to Colorado. And the court found that that witness's testimony would be material and that she was unavailable. And they identified that she would be available at a later date. They weren't able to give a specific later date, apart from about 6 weeks, I think, after the general due date.
Well, Mr. Michaels, in this case, the deposition was taken to preserve the testimony, wasn't it?
Yes.
I mean, the anticipation was, as I understand the record, is this witness was going to be unavailable. So let's take his deposition. Let's make sure that we have it video recorded on video, give an opportunity for cross-examination, and that's the testimony.
Certainly. And that was the initial assumption, that he being Mr. Cummings, would not be available for the first trial. And lo and behold, he didn't ship out until almost immediately after he was able to testify in the first trial. In the meantime, the video testimony was taken before any of the witnesses had testified. They weren't able to respond to any of the concerns. They weren't able to introduce evidence through him through this video deposition. It was simply a video deposition, which is still one step removed. And this court and the Colorado Supreme Court have long held that the best evidence is live testimony. We have a preference to put on not just a deposition, not to read something that's cold, not to view a video of testimony unless there's no other way of getting this defendant there. And here the witness was able to and did in fact testify within 6 weeks of the extended trial testimony, the extended continuance. One of the things that this court would look at is to what extent was the defendant prejudiced, and this is just a six-week extension beyond what's already a discretionary continuance in essence. In terms of the first trial and the first trial testimony and the deposition, the defense counsel spent a good deal of time identifying Mr. Cummings, Mr. Medina, and Eduardo Castillo as being three key witnesses, and suggested that Mr. Medina had a hard time identifying because he was driving the opposing car as he was driving away at high rates of speed. Eduardo Castillo's testimony was somewhat self-serving and somewhat contradictory. And Mr. Cummings' testimony was the predominant testimony of an eyewitness who was there, who put the gun in Mr. Baez's hands. Mr. Cummings, however, was routinely and savagely attacked his credibility throughout the first trial, and that was something that wasn't anticipated in the deposition. And the prosecution is not required to accept a stipulation from the defendant. They're allowed to put on all the best evidence for proving their case.
Mr. Michaels, could the people make the same argument if Mr. Cummings were not going to be back from Iraq for 6 months after a speedy trial, or a year from the date of speedy trial?
I think that's a very different question, because at this point we had the information that he was going to be here in a very timely manner immediately following the expiration of the 3-month speedy trial extension. A year is entirely different, because that puts it beyond that 6-month extension that's discretionary to the trial court. And even 6 months becomes much more questionable, because again, that's just so much further out. It's so much less definite. Here, if he hadn't shown up after 6 weeks, probably the trial court would have turned around and said, okay, Mr. Prosecutor, we had your best interest. We looked at this, and we had a really good faith effort of showing this witness can be available and will be available on this date. He's not, we're going to go ahead. But here, the time delay is so minimal that it's not presumptively prejudicial. And I cited a slew of cases in my answer brief that talks about delay is significantly longer than this, that this court has declined to hold prejudicial.
Well, Mr. Michaels, let me ask you this. Mr. Huff claims that the prosecution did not exercise due diligence in trying to get Mr. Cummings back here sooner,
sure,
back in the States, sooner than he would have returned anyway. Just what kind of efforts did the prosecution go to in trying to speed up Mr. Cummings' return, if any?
Well, to the extent that the prosecution tried to speed up his return, I think that was well out of the prosecution's hands. I know several members of this panel have served on the military, and I know that their privates are subject to essentially the deployment dates and the deployment times. But what the prosecutor did do was it talked to numerous of Mr. Cummins' commanding officers, military personnel here in the States, and Mr. Cummings' parents, who all kept saying, it's going to be early January or mid-January, and then finally they got a date for that January 17th. I don't think unavailability and due diligence require the prosecutor to get in contact directly with Mr. Cummings when he's across half the world deployed on combat missions, where it may not be feasible at all. Additionally, in People versus Roberts, which I cited earlier, underscores this, the defendant didn't ask for specific instances of every time the prosecution tried to exercise due diligence. Due diligence only requires that the prosecution makes an offer of proof to the court saying, I've really tried to do this, here's what we've come up with, here's where we're left with, and this is these are the efforts we've gone to. In Roberts, they talk about how the prosecution or the defense didn't ask for specific instances of conduct. And again, this was more towards the materiality prong of the analysis. But the Supreme Court credited the prosecution's offer of proof, and it said, we can accept the prosecution at its word as long as it's clear the prosecution made these efforts and as long as they're not being contested. And that's what we have here. The prosecution said, look, we've really been trying to get him to come here, and this is what we've got. We know he's going to be here by mid-January. Does that answer your question, Your Honor?
Yes, thank you.
I want to talk very briefly about the second issue, and I think defense counsel and I both agree that this witness, Mr. Castillo Jr., was very clearly unavailable. I think at this point he might have actually been convicted, but again, I'm not quite sure of just how the timing worked out. But the issue of reliability is something that I think we have here very well established. I know Judge Graham and Your Honor Judge Hoffman both indicated that he put himself at the scene of the crime. He put himself as driving away. He told his dad that we were out, we were looking for these guys. I wasn't the one with the gun, but I was there with the gun and I was driving. I think that's enough to indicate the statement against interest prong that subjects him to penal interest. In terms of the indicia of reliability, I think we can look at the defendant's opening brief's very argument against it being harmless because he talks about how detailed these responses were in terms of the reliability. The fact that Castillo Jr.'s statements were so detailed are what make them much more reliable. And the fact that he's scared and telling his dad, and he's probably trying to explain the situation to his father. People versus Gash, which I cited in my answer brief, deals with a very similar case where you have a defendant talking to, I believe it's his nephew or maybe the nephew and vice versa, but he's talking about all these self-inculpatory statements. And this court held that makes them, in fact, even more reliable that you're talking to a family member or a friend.
But Mr. Michaels, in this situation, didn't Mr. Castillo Jr. have a motive to try and deflect blame from himself? I think it's different from if he had been talking to a police officer, but he was still trying to say to his father, hey, I wasn't involved I was just playing a minor role here.
I think that might be true to a point. He's saying that he wasn't the one who did the shooting, but he was saying that he was involved in a shooting, which in terms of an inculpatory statement in the eyes of the law is a statement against interest. And so that's where I think the difference is. Yes, he's trying to tell his father that I was there, this is what happened to the car. There was no indication that he was being dishonest.
But how is that any different from in a situation where there are co-defendants and one of them tries to shift blame to the other when they're talking to a police officer, whereas here Castillo Jr. is trying to shift blame away from himself when he's talking to his father?
The difference is actually quite large, Your Honor, and I talk about it to some extent in my answer brief. But when you're talking to a police officer, you're trying to shift it legally in the eyes of the law, saying, I wasn't the one who did it, it was the other person. When you're talking to a non-police officer, you're talking to somebody who can't establish a legal case against you. You're more likely to be honest to somebody who is a family member. And I would direct the court to look at my answer brief. I don't have pages numbered off the top of my head. And again, before I move on to the third issue very quickly, I would just say that this trial occurred over 1,500 pages of testimony, and Hector Castillo Sr.'s testimony was a grand total of 50 pages. And of that, the testimony about Hector Castillo Jr. was very small and essentially entirely cumulative to the other witnesses. I do want to talk about the direct file issue very quickly because this issue hasn't come up directly in Colorado. But before I get into the merits of it, and I see I have a minute and a half to just discuss that, it's the defendant's duty to ask for a ruling regarding that issue, and he didn't. So therefore, this court shouldn't even be properly in front of this court. But if this court wants to discuss it, I do want to address the merits very quickly. Implicit in Baez's argument is that the statutory maximum sentence is what's considered under the juvenile sentencing statute, and that's just not the case. The juvenile code is an exception to the criminal code, and that's been recognized all the way back to the U.S. Supreme Court cases in Reed Gault. One of the cases I cited in my answer brief, People versus Rudy, the New Mexico case, talks about this issue in quite a bit of detail, and I would strongly direct this court there. But one of the things it talks about is that Apprendi, first of all, deals with sentencing considerations after conviction, whereas the direct file issue is a jurisdictional claim before trial, before any adjudication of guilt whatsoever. The Rudy case also cites a Supreme Court case, Oregon versus ICE, that talks about whether to expand Apprendi beyond just the sentencing determinations, and specifically beyond whether it's something that a jury has routinely decided. And a jury has never routinely decided whether to try a juvenile in adult court or criminal court. In fact, from the common law on, it was routine that a juvenile would be tried in adult court, and the juvenile statute has created an exception to that. So in summation, it's a jurisdictional matter, not a sentencing matter. That I ask that you affirm his convictions and sentence.
Thank you, Mr. Michaels. Mr. Huff, you have about
1 minute.
1 minute.
Yeah. Less than 1 minute. Okay, very quickly, on the speedy trial issue, I want to emphasize the witness was unavailable. That is not in dispute. But the statute doesn't speak in terms of a witness's unavailability. It speaks in terms of whether the evidence was unavailable. The evidence in this case was not unavailable. He was deposed. He was cross-examined. He was directed. It was videotaped. There was then a transcript of his testimony. That's the evidence. That was not unavailable. Surely, yes, there is a preference for live testimony, but this was about as close as you can get, and it's not a preference over your right to have your case tried within the speedy trial period. Number two, confrontation issue. Prosecutor argues it was exculpatory. An unsophisticated person who doesn't know the nuances of complicity law is going to say, yeah, I was there, I didn't do it. That is not inculpatory. That is very exculpatory. Thank you.
Mr. Huff, yes. I know your time is up, but I just would like to ask you if you could respond to Mr. Michael's point about the direct file issue, about whether the defendant asked for a ruling from the trial court on that issue.
It was not raised below. It is nevertheless a constitutional issue, and this court, as well as our Supreme Court, has decided that under some circumstances, constitutional issues concerning sentencing, concerning Apprendi-Blakely type issues, will be reviewed on appeal, regardless of whether or not they were preserved below.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Huff. Thank you again, Mr. Michaels. Thanks to both counsel for your excellent arguments. They were helpful to the court. The matter is deemed submitted, and you can expect a written opinion to issue in due course.